Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, August 10th, 2015. My name is Matt Binder.
I'm Michael Brooks.
And this is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting to you live, steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal.
In the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Stephen W. Thrasher, writer at large for The Guardian. He's going to join us to talk about how Black Lives Matter has shown us that oppression of black people is a global phenomenon. There's an interesting colonial history there. There's interesting parallels in terms of global movements and, frankly, global oppression. We're going to get to that with him. Also, President Obama makes a very strong case for the Iran deal and finally places it more firmly in the context of really what allowed him to become president in the first place, which was opposition to the invasion of Iraq. Also going to be touching on Chuck Schumer and his ridiculous objections to the deal. And we have a lot more, including, of course, your calls and IMs in the better half. But we should get pretty quickly to this music here because we are running pretty late. But suffice to say, we have a full show for you. Sorry we started late. But if you're listening to this later, you will obviously notice no difference. So we're going to take a brief break, and we'll be right back with Stephen W. Thrasher.
Watch them, I wonder what they do. Rastafari calling, respect you. Babylon falling, I could have what do you. Mighty and brawling, I saw we are got you. Me they are from morning, they give you something new. With me back, pam, me back, and me cocky suit. Me listen to them, me a thought they do. The fire, hotter than a cup of coffee tea. A scotty beast and a boy like hearty soup. Why, oh, when time is about from the stage show, people recognize everywhere when we go. Say I don't want their name, Chronic. Watch it. Oh, why, oh, why, oh. Back from me back, you don't know where we go. Could a sunshine, I could a heen, and this snow. Me say I mean name, Chronic. Welcome. Teflon up a tampampa, we no big and borrow. Have a special sponsor excuse. Babylon a fret and wonder if we depend ganja and I make all kind of excuse. Give me the big bad
pretty. Welcome back to the Majority Report. I'm Michael Brooks. Joining us now is Stephen W. Thrasher. He's a writer at large for The Guardian US. Stephen, how you doing?
I'm well. Thanks for having me on.
It's great to have you on. I really appreciate you taking the time. So you have a new a piece out that came out recently. I think it was over the weekend or on Friday. And it's called Black Lives Matter Showed Us the Oppression of Black People is Borderless. Explain what you mean by that. Set the context for this conversation.
Sure. You know, writing for The Guardian US, I have this unique opportunity to sort of write for a British and worldwide audience as well as an American audience. As we've seen in The Guardian with the Edward Snowden stories, we write things that are very particular to the United States but can have worldwide implications. Mm-hmm. And I actually set out, I tried to walk the line between both, but actually wrote this piece very specifically for our British and international readers because I wanted to think about the ways that this was not just an American phenomenon that's happened over the past year, but how it related to things happening politically worldwide with black people.
Yeah, and I think that partially what I really appreciated about your piece, I appreciate a lot about your piece, but you were setting it. In order to get the global setting, you need to have a historical setting. So you talked about how really, and correct me if I'm wrong, but in some senses, when you start, first of all, by introducing the notion, obviously, that race is a constructed thing, and there is a specific colonial and imperial history to that construction. And then when you talk about, as an example, relating it to Palestinian human rights or Ethiopian Jews in Israel, which I'd like you to elaborate on, you're, and I think that this has actually come up in, and I apologize that I'm kind of jumping a little bit here, but I think it all can be packed together. You know, the problematic and delusional response to Black Lives Matter with All Lives Matter. And we've discussed a lot why that's, you know, that's a problem. And you can elaborate on that too, obviously. But I think what you're doing, which is interesting, which is that in a certain sense, Black Lives Matter is very specific to a present, you know, historical condition in America and a present crisis. And a long-term crisis with policing and the sort of state apparatus and black people. But then when you start talking about Palestinians and you start talking about, you know, people just sort of on the receiving end of power structure, essentially, it seems to me that black lives start to represent something that is, you know, it's global black lives, but it's also just sort of global lives on the receiving end of oppression. Does that make sense? Is that a correct read?
Yeah, it definitely does. I mean, I came to this column in this way of thinking through a couple of different paths. First would probably be thinking back on my childhood when my father was involved with the anti-apartheid campaigns in the 1980s, in early 1990, 91, until Mandela got out. And back then, you know, we didn't have the internet. People were very isolated in how they were able to connect about these things and organize around these things. And so there was kind of no, my father died about 10 years ago, and I'm sad he never sort of had the validation and joy I think he would have had if he had been living in this time, of being able to connect with other people and see other people in similar struggles. And I think that's a lot of how race has been connected. In addition to my work for The Guardian, I'm also a doctoral student in American Studies, and a lot of what I have been looking at is how race was a social construct that was made in particular ways through slavery here in the United States, but also very much through colonialism, particularly British colonialism, and how our notions of what it means to be black or be white and the advantages or disadvantages that have manifested themselves through law and society are relatively new. They're only a few hundred years old in our, you know, in our long human history on this planet. So I've been interested in trying to kind of figure out how has that process separated us from one another. And I very much feel like in my childhood, you know, my father and the people he was involved with would sort of be laughed at for wanting to have something to do with South Africa, and what do you care about something that's happening 9,000 miles away? And and I could, now I can sort of understand how we were very much encouraged to think of ourselves as separate, and at kind of best to say, well, you're lucky you could be in the United States, you could have been in poor Africa, and stop complaining. And so I think what's really beautiful and fascinating right now is you see this circulation happening very quickly, that we have an ability to connect with each other around the globe, to see what problems are happening in other places, to understand how, you know, as I wrote in my column about that hard to watch but really beautiful Slate interactive map that shows how slavery moved around the world, we can kind of see how these patterns are playing out in different places. One of the most controversial but I think fascinating was to see how Black Lives Matter was connecting in Palestine. There was a historic trip that happened between young people that went both directions. Palestinians came to the United States and Black Americans went to Palestine. And they got to see what that was like. I was in the occupied territories about 5 or 6 years ago, and that was the first time I had really had a sense of how, kind of at their best, when Israelis will hold up sort of a model idea of what works well, they'll often talk about the city of Haifa as being a good coexistence. And at best, I think it kind of looks like our segregated South in the 60s. And that's kind of the best situation. What's happening in the occupied territories is much more oppressive. So I think it's so fascinating to see very young people making these links. And then, as I also wrote in my piece, it was fascinating also to see Ethiopian Israelis also invoke Black Lives Matter, to see that as they were realizing, they were being, not realizing, but as fighting back against police abuse that they experience as Black Israelis in a complicated society that's not, you know, it's not exactly analogous to the United States, but they could understand how this was quite like what was happening in Baltimore. So to see Black Lives Matter sort of being invoked by Palestinians and also by Black Israelis made me realize this can, you know, this idea can kind of travel anywhere. And it's so kind of fascinating and in a way joyous to see these ideas jumping from academia to hip hop, you know, across different countries and just moving very fast in a very different way than when I think back on how my dad was involved in these letter writing campaigns and things like that that happened with apartheid. It was not happening so quickly.
Right. And the ANC, I'm sure, would have had a very sophisticated social media campaign. And actually, in some ways, the ANC, with their sort of use of cultural diplomacy and things like that, were sort of forerunners of some of this type of activism. It's really interesting. But I want to touch again on Israel for a moment. I mean, we talk about certainly that issue sometimes on this show. Almost everybody on this show has some Jewish background. And it is an interesting thing taken from, like, if you read, as an example, even Malcolm X, and I don't think he had a particular focus on this issue, but in his sort of Nation of Islam phase, he would throw Israel out as an example of, like, well, that's a good thing, because that's a state for the Jewish people, and you need a state for the Black people, and you need a state for, you know, Korean people, whatever, the sort of, you know, sense of separation. And then, you know, it seemed like his kind of views of that shifted in his more sort of global kind of anti-colonialist solidarity phase. And I think, you know, the perception of what Israel is inside movements in the United States, when at certain times it's been seen as this kind of place of refuge for people who've been victims of genocide, sort of setting up their own in some respects, socialist system, frankly. And then recently, and over the past several decades, obviously it's really formed into something quite different in the progressive imagination. And it seemed like for a little while, a lot of people wanted to kind of avoid that conversation because of how controversial it is. But it's popping up very strongly in Black Lives Matter. And I guess, I mean, and I think, is just to underscore what you're saying, is that your sort of prime example in many ways of just how global this is at this point?
I mean, yeah, it is. I wouldn't necessarily say it's better or worse. I think, and I could talk, you know, a little bit more about Israel, my evolution of thinking about it. Mm-hmm. But kind of the two big international things that popped out at me were seeing this existing in both Israel and Palestine, but also a plethora of great writing about Sisal the Lion. And how people have reacted to the death of this lion. And it's been interesting to watch writers and myself sort of examine why is it that we as a society react in a certain way to the death of a lion differently than the death of Black Americans. But then also, for me, also to think about, okay, we shouldn't just think about Black Americans, but what does this mean for people in Zimbabwe? And how are we privileging our own, like, kind of our own conversation about it versus the lived reality of people in Zimbabwe? And what does this say about colonialism? And it's not simple. I think that there are great critiques of colonialism in the way the lion was hunted. There are also great critiques of it in forgetting about what a lion means in the country where it was, and that they might not think about it the same way that we do. And that, of course,
elaborate on that. What's the Cecil story in all of this?
Well, initially there was, you know, the initial critique was that this lion was being prized more than the lives of Black Americans. Mm-hmm. And I thought that there was a very fair critique in saying that there's something gross and colonialist about Americans or people from Europe going to any of these countries and sort of paying tens of thousands of dollars and taking something that is considered a national prize and just thinking we can pay for it and go take it. But then it was really interesting for me to read, particularly there was a piece written by a graduate student and published in the New York Times, I think, last week, about what the role of the lion is there and how people don't necessarily love lions. But also that he was just so surprised at how much outpouring people were saying that they felt sorry for him. And he said people who, you know, seem concerned about the death of the lion, but not about the way the lions kill people. And more importantly, and sort of more at a larger scale, that they had never expressed much in the ways that his countrymen and countrywomen had suffered by colonialism and by economics and hunger that was caused not just, you know, death that was caused not just by a lion. So that I thought was really, you know, quite interesting to read at several levels. In terms of Israel and Palestine, you know, my own experience, which was not long, I was just in that region of the world for a few weeks, several years ago, but it was really amazing for me. I had spent, prior to that, I had been touring around the United States with the NPR StoryCorps project, and I was collecting stories about the civil rights experience of the 1960s and 50s for their GRIOT project, African American project. And in the South, I was just experiencing firsthand stories from people about segregation and what it was like to be just very overtly controlled by race in a way that I usually haven't been. My parents and grandparents were. But my experience with racism had not been so overt. And shortly after I had that experience, I was in Israel and Palestine, and the first few weeks I was there, I was with an Israeli friend, and I was mostly in private settings. But the second half of my trip, I traveled by myself, and I was mostly alone and using public settings. And people typically thought that I was Arab or Palestinian from my appearance. So I got to experience kind of what that felt like as a single man of sort of prime age where one is considered suspicious traveling alone. Ultimately, my American passport got me out of every problematic situation I was in, so I had that level of privilege. But it was really amazing for me to see how completely people are policed in a way we would find entirely inappropriate here in the United States.
Sure.
And yet it, you know, is as violent and overt as our forms of segregation looked, you know, in this country decades ago, but it's just everyday life there. And then, you know, I don't like to say that we are divorced from that at all in the United States. Fast forward to Ferguson, including last night, and we see that the same forms of really violent racial segregation and freedom of movement are being imposed again. So I think that it's really great that the young people are talking to each other about what it feels like to be occupied. And certainly as a journalist, I feel like I've been operating in occupied space the past year when I've been reporting in places like Baltimore or Ferguson, mm-hmm. and the police are directly telling us that we have to leave and can't do our work. It certainly does feel like a military occupation.
So what do you see emerging from this? You're talking about, you know, and it's interesting because in some ways it's a story that tracks with, you know, many things, which is sort of in some respects the positive aspects of technology collapsing borders, allowing people to have more kind of peer-to-peer conversations. What do you sort of see coming out of this? What kind of new tactics, creativity, organizing, or even just ways of people understanding themselves and their context? Like what's the upshot of a kind of globalized Black Lives Matter over the coming decade?
The upshot is that most people in this world are not white. so that there's
really?
No reason why they so that they should there's no reason why they should not have, you know, political power in the connection of their voices, and that things that operate from white supremacy should not be allowed. People are often kept segmented from each other, but I think if they're able to be in conversation with each other, that should give you know, strength to their arguments and strength to the movement. And I think it's really interesting, you know, as I've been sort of studying in grad school about economics and you know, looking at things from a Marxist critique, I think that Occupy Wall Street really sort of wanted to have this either some format of Marxist or Marxist light attempt to connect people who felt oppressed and to band together their collective ability.
Yes, it did.
And it didn't quite work. I mean, not that it is a part of what's happening now, but it had a hard time. It had a very difficult time with race, and it had a really hard time sort of getting to an escape velocity momentum of connecting different people in different places. It didn't quite get through its first year. And Black Lives Matter has gone through a year, which is a pretty big thing to have done. And it is connecting these people in all these different places. And I think it sort of stands in its next frontier, as we're seeing a little bit play out right now. It stands to try to actually connect white people against some of the shared oppression. There's a Zachary Hammond case, a young man who was killed by police. And I think it's getting to a point where it's starting to raise some consciousness about how white people are oppressed by police. And there are almost a million black people in prison, but there are about a million white people in prison.
And that class is really the intersecting, thing that I think. That's certainly from my perspective. I'm informed, I guess, by that kind of Marxist reading too, and I think that class is really, it's almost it's off. I mean, obviously in America it's a very underrepresented aspect of the conversation, and then when you connect it with race, that's a whole zone that nobody wants to get near. But I think the one thing that, and I know that just because a lot of people that listen to and watch this program care and think a lot about, and I haven't wanted to sort of overly pay attention, frankly, to Black Lives Matter and Bernie Sanders, because I think, I've talked about it. I talked about it on HuffPost Live a couple weeks ago. We covered the initial thing at Netroots Nation, which I actually thought was demonstrably it was effective activism, because look at what's happened as a result. But I know that some people are very kind of upset by what happened in Seattle. I'll be blunt. I don't really think I don't think it was effective. I think at the same time, that is a sort of place that starts to bring up very familiar and very difficult questions about how do you have community without unity, or unity without community, or, how do you make bridges without obscuring? We talked about President Obama's campaign in some ways as this kind of brilliant branding of kind of obscuring, in some respects, really core differences in race and class. And now, at least electorally, Bernie Sanders is obviously representing at least something on a class level. How that movement relates to his campaign and how that campaign relates to its Black Lives Matter, that's a difficult territory. And it's going to bring out a lot of problems. And I just kind of want to get your impression of it before we end the conversation.
Sure. I mean, the biggest hole, I think Sanders has had two holes ideologically from my particular leftist perspective. One has been gun control, which I think he's going to have to wrestle with and is wrestling with just because of what happens every week in this country. The other big blind spot I thought he's had is race. He has a way, I think his economic platform is a much, much potentially better one for people of color than Obama's all boats will be lifted by the rising tide if we subsidize Wall Street approach. But he has had this big hole, which I think the Black Lives Matter people have actually done a very good job of getting him to confront and argue with. And it's going to be uncomfortable. I think that Seattle had a result. He hired this young black woman a few hours later. She's actually, initiated as a spokeswoman. She's initiated some really great conversation. That's the same day that we found out that a lot of the leaders of the movement have been meeting with the Democratic nominees. So, I personally don't have a problem with people grabbing the mic. I don't think anything really bad comes from it. It makes people talk about it more. It's not hurting Sanders. He just keeps going up. But I do think, we are in this place of crisis, which I think is much easier for white people, and maybe especially for white progressive allies, people who are very staunch Bernie Sanders. It's much easier for them to not understand how this affects us. So last night, I'm not in Ferguson now. I've been there four times this year. but I couldn't really sleep last night once I started seeing what was happening on Twitter. And it's a level of anxiety I live with a lot, and lots of black people I know live with. And having to address that constantly, even when it's uncomfortable in some creative way, it causes for the need for disruption. So I think that the people in Seattle they were not ill-intentioned, and they actually got a little bit of results. And there'll be things that happen that aren't perfect, but the conflict and the conversation are necessary to keep happening as long as this crisis continues.
Right. And I would hope, you know, I would like to see, I think the paradox is that, you know, Hillary Clinton's campaign is much less accessible and open. So it sort of leaves the paradox of, you know, Bernie's more accessible so that this can happen to him more just functionally. But I think, you know, I would really like to see, I guess I would not only like to see it with Hillary Clinton, but I actually think with Bernie, it's more of, it's not positive either, more omission and delusion in some ways. I think with the Clintons, there's actually a very specific and very, very wrongheaded history on some of these issues, which really do need to be ironed out, at least during the primary, whether it's three strikes laws, whether it's signing, you know, Ray Rector's death warrant, or frankly, even something like welfare reform, which has been a part of, you know, Bill Clinton's legacy in the mainstream, but something that had a really disastrous effect on poor people across the board, and obviously particularly African-Americans and Hispanic people, in my view. So I hope that this can be sort of broadened out. But it's very important. And, you know, this is not only what primaries are for. I guess this is also just, you know, this is much bigger than any presidential election.
I largely agree. And I think that the Clintons have reason to be very nervous right now. As you said about access, I mean, it sounds like they are talking to their campaign, but you know, I've been engaging with people one-on-one in conversation about why they don't turn this to the Republicans. And of course, it's a lost cause. They can't get near them, and having watched the debate last week, they have no interest. It was my column right before that was that they devoted less than 1 minute to Black Lives Matter. So it's almost in a way by taking the people who you think are closest aligned to you and trying to convince them how important this is that, you know, it's important. And I think the Black Lives Matter people are going to, those activists are incredibly creative and resilient. I think they're going to find really interesting and entertaining ways to take on the Republicans in the general. But it's not sort of important to deal with them in an electoral season because they're not going to get anyone electoral.
No, I think it's important to deal with Hillary Clinton. I agree with the Republicans. Yeah. I think the Republicans are, I mean, they're a white party, let's be honest, right? I mean, that is not, yeah. I mean, the responses on that stage, even frankly by their standards, were pathetic. So no question.
Yeah.
They need to be focusing on so-called allies right now. But I do think with Clinton, not just her personally, but the sort of politics that they represent, even just historically in the 80s and 90s, that has a lot to do with this sort of modern legacy when Democratic politicians embraced expanding prisons, drug laws, and all the rest of it. And that needs to be accounted for as well.
Yes.
I really appreciate your time, Stephen. It was great having you on. The piece is Black Lives Matter showed us the oppression of black people is borderless. It's linked to on our website, majority.fm. And thanks so much, Stephen. Be in touch.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
510, what's your name? Where are you calling from?
Matt in the Silicon Valley, Brooklyn native.
What's up, Matt in the Silicon Valley? How you doing?
Good, good. You know, I was just calling on this whole Bernie Sanders.
Yeah.
You know, I'm all for a protest, but that seemed a little stalkish to me. You know, I'm hearing they're gonna do the same thing over and over again. And then my question is, how do you deal with that in a non-confrontational way? If you're on that stage, how do you actually?
I think Bernie handled it this time much better than he did the last time. I think if I was in his shoes, I would definitely let them speak like he did this time around. It's unfortunate that the supporters of his who were there seem to have ruined that moment because, I mean, let's be quite clear here. These Black Lives Matter activists came onto the stage to protest, and Bernie conceded the mic to them. He let them speak. And, I mean, I truly don't know how I would handle his supporters' reaction if I was him. Perhaps get up there and stand with them. I would perhaps even take up their issue right then and there if I was him. Speak right, whatever he was going, I think he was there to talk about Social Security. A great issue to speak about, but at that moment, I would just go ahead and roll with it. I would say, let's talk about Black Lives Matter, because to me they do. And this is what I would do to prove to you, to show to you that Black Lives Matter. And this is what I would do to speak to the issues that Black Lives Matter are bringing to the forefront. And I thank them for doing this because while I agree with everything they have to say, and I've been fighting for them for 50 years, and I would run down what I've been doing, perhaps I haven't been speaking to them on the issues of the now and today as clearly as I should have been. And let me fix that right now. And he could go right then and there and speak to those issues. And I think that would do worlds of help. I think it would shut down his... That's the best way to shut down his supporters, because they would say, oh, wait, Bernie wants to talk about it. Let's listen.
He needs a strategy.
Even if you are this... You're a person who thinks they're being rude and they're being mean and you don't agree with them and how they're doing it. I mean, that just doesn't matter. The point is, this is a game. Politics is a game. And he needs to play the game. And he can't let something like this hurt him. I mean, it hasn't. I mean, honestly, I'm going to get into this right now really quickly. I'm glad you brought this up. I'm going to let you go and get into this right now, okay?
Sure.
I just want to speak really quickly to, you know, white liberal progressives who support Bernie Sanders. I am a Bernie Sanders supporter, too. I am, without a doubt, voting for him in the Democratic primaries. It's why I am a registered Democrat, so I can strategically vote, even though I am often more to the left and more progressive than whoever's running for in the Democratic Party. It's so I can vote for the best person to represent the Democratic Party. And to me, that person is the person with the progressive views, with the leftist views, with the person who can do the most good for me and, in my view, the most good for the American people as a whole. And this time around, it is Bernie Sanders. Without a doubt, Bernie Sanders has a record that proves that he cares about a multitude of issues. The middle class, economic inequality. He cares about Black Lives Matter. And Black Lives Matter is absolutely right to do what they've been doing to Bernie Sanders. Now, whether you want to agree with exactly what they've been saying, I don't agree with everything. I don't agree with exactly every small detail about it. I was completely on board that first protest. I think they should continue to do these type of protests. This previous one in Seattle, I'm completely on board with them interrupting Bernie. Do I agree with everything they said? Maybe not. But that doesn't matter, and it shouldn't. Because we are now in the time frame where you should be pushing whoever you want your candidate to be to speak to your issues. You want them to become a perfect candidate by the time this all kicks into full gear and we're getting close to that primary vote. You want, if you're a Bernie Sanders supporter, you want as many African-American voters to go out there and vote for Bernie Sanders, because they need, if you truly care about Black lives, then you'd vote for Bernie Sanders. Well, guess what? This is what they need to do so they can be sure that Bernie Sanders is their candidate. Black Lives Matter is absolutely right to interrupt Bernie Sanders. It's protest. And when it comes to protesters, individual citizens, activists, and a politician, regardless of how good that politician is or how much I agree with them, you as a progressive should always support and side with the activist, the protester, the individual. Because when it comes down to it, Bernie Sanders is a politician. And if you want something from him, you need to force his hand. It's that simple. And to the argument that Bernie Sanders is being hurt by this, I don't see it. How do you argue that Bernie Sanders is being hurt by Black Lives Matter interrupting him at Netroots Nation, Black Lives Matter activists interrupting him at his at a Seattle gathering, and they ended up actually shutting that gathering down, fine. And I understand that there were some angry Bernie Sanders supporters who booed him, who booed the Black Lives Matter activists. And I get the booing. You know, if you're waiting outside for like an hour and a half to see somebody, politician that you support, or anyone you want to, you know, any sort of politician, celebrity, whatever, and someone stops you from seeing them after an hour and a half, I guess you would boo. That's an okay, I guess, thing off the bat. But then some of these things I've been hearing with the chants of the All Lives Matter and Bernie Matters, come on. You're progressives. That's not an instinct like, boo, we wanted to see Bernie. Oh, okay, let's, you know, let's listen to them for a bit. This is, that's bad. But to the result, the accusation this is hurting Bernie. The day after those Black Lives Matter activists shut down that Seattle Bernie Sanders gathering, a record-breaking 28,000 people came to a rally in Portland, Oregon to support his presidential campaign and see him speak. That is the largest turnout for any 2016 presidential candidate thus far, and it broke the previous record, which was also set by Bernie Sanders. In fact, as we heard from someone who just called in earlier, Black Lives Matter activists showed up to support Bernie as part of that 28,000 people group at that rally in Portland. How is this hurting Bernie Sanders? And again, here's another issue. If Bernie's saying and talking about Black Lives Matter and educating himself on, okay, I've been fighting for the issues for 50 years and I'm continuing to fight for these issues, but maybe I'm not in tune with what's going on with this specific activist group. The language, the politics, the specific activism and on the ground grassroots organizing that's going on. And it's completely fine for someone to claim ignorance on this. He's a sitting senator. He can't be sitting on Twitter or following the internet forums to figure out, you know, this is what's going on here, this is what's going on there. That's what his campaign is there to do for him. He's got a lot to pay attention to. And to prove that he cares and that he wants to pay attention to this and he needs someone and he wants someone to inform him on these issues so he can be a better ally to the Black Lives Matter group, he's gone out and he has hired a young black woman by the name of Simone Sanders. She's a young black criminal justice advocate and supporter of the Black Lives Matter movement. She's a progressive political activist who she last worked with Public Citizen. She's an organizer with the D.C.-based Coalition for Juvenile Justice. And I believe she's also been an organizer with the local D.C. Black Lives Matter chapter. And she is now part of the Bernie Sanders campaign. She's a public face even. She spoke at this 28,000-strong rally. And I'm not saying Bernie Sanders doesn't care about Black Lives. No one's saying that. But what we're saying is Bernie Sanders would not have realized he needs to speak to this now. Not in the past, not in the future. He needs to speak to this now if the Black Lives Matter activists did not push him on this. And I don't see, you know, if you want to argue, then there's a lot of conspiracies out there right now that these people are being paid by Hillary and they're in the pocket of maybe even the GOP because it's come out that the woman from Seattle, one of the women who interrupted him in Seattle, she had a Facebook post where she talked about how in high school she had a Sarah Palin pin and she was a GOP supporter. You know, whatever. You know, you can be. I mean, I don't see how any of these conspiracy. Listen, let's speak to these conspiracies right now. I don't put it past the Hillary campaign to pay agitators to hurt any sort of possible serious threat to her campaign. Do I think that's what happened here? No, I do not. I absolutely don't. I think it's too early to determine. You know, a lot of people are saying, why don't these people go after Hillary? Why don't the Black Lives Matter activists go after Hillary? I mean, it's just too early to determine. I don't see why they won't. It's a lot harder to do so at a Hillary campaign stop. She's got way too many handlers and security surrounding her. But until we get to the wire there and they've yet to do any sort of action on Hillary, I just don't see any sort of baseless claims. And to the conspiracy that these are Republican-paid agitators because one of these Black Lives Matter activists had this Sarah Palin pin in high school or whatever, that's just ludicrous. We just saw who the GOP sees as a threat at this past Republican debate, if you didn't already know. How many times did Hillary Clinton's name come up at either of those two Republican debates that we saw, the kids' table earlier in the night and then the main event? The Republican Party's not looking at Bernie Sanders. If they're going to pay agitators, it's going to be to go after Hillary. If Bernie Sanders wins the nomination, then fine. We can start looking out for these Republican agitators. But until then, Bernie Sanders isn't even a blip on their radar. These are just baseless conspiracies, and they're silly. Come on, progressives. We're better than Alex Jones.
All right, folks. I think we are going to go straight to the fun half, where we have many stories. And we have your IMs. I'm going to open up the phone lines. Would love to hear from you. How was your weekend, Matt?
It was good, Michael.
Are you tired?
A little bit.
A little bit? How's it going? How is being
going
a father?
Good. It's going good.
All right. So it's 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. I don't know why I can't find the call-in system. Okay, I got it. 646-257-3920. You know the deal, folks. You know that this program relies on your memberships. It relies on your support, and that's why the Majority Report is a special thing. It's why you can get the a different angle on the history of anti-apartheid activism, and you can get the right-wing Mandela character. It's why you can take a deep dive into Social Security actuarial reports, and I don't know, Libertarian Gandhi, whatever. It's a unique show, as you know. We appreciate all the support that all of you who do support us give. And if you can do so, please do become a member today. It makes a tremendous difference. I mean, not only does it make a difference, it literally is about 98% of why this show exists, even with the advertising that we sometimes get. And you know, the Indiegogo campaign went great. We have a lot more coming for you out of that. Download the app, majority.fm/app. Use our Amazon link to buy all of your stuff through Amazon. I mean, that's couldn't be more obvious. Just Coffee at justcoffee.coop. Fair Trade Coffee. Get the Majority Report blend. It's delicious. We drink. That's what fuels this fight every day on the show. I want to thank intern Noah again. It was his last day Thursday during the debates. He did a fantastic job. And unfortunately, Matt, actually, I don't know, Matt, can you get up for a second and get me that bottle of wine? Could you grab that for me?
Don't talk to me like I'm some sort of intern.
Give me 10. Are you all right?
Yeah.
I just want to show this in case Noah's parents are listening. They bought me a Texas Malbec, and I will probably kill about half of this before yoga tonight. So thank you so much, Noah. Thank you to his parents. Doing the debates was really fun. 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920. We'll see you in the fun half.